I found the amount of birch bark Gadfly had acquired for me a great deal more daunting. It was piled higher than the chair itself, evidence of his expectations.
"I fear it will be quite late by the time we've finished supper," Gadfly said, drawing up beside me. "Perhaps you would grace us with your craft tomorrow morning?"
And he pulled out the chair at the head of the table. I dearly wished I could have refused the honor, but it would be impolite, and all glittering eyes were upon me. I curtsied, and as I sat, Rook took wing from my shoulder and transformed next to me in time to push my chair back in. Gadfly deferred to him with a smile, while I wondered if that had been at all a wise thing for Rook to do. The fair folk came forward and took their seats. Lark sat on my left and Rook on my right. Gadfly went all the way down the table and sat last at the foot, directly across from me, half obscured by the delicacies mounded up over the long distance. With a rustle of silk and muslin, everyone else descended to their places. The feast that followed was bizarrely fascinating. Rather than using spoons, forks, or ladles, the fair folk simply took what they wanted using their fingers. So beautiful were their forms, and so delicate their movements, that the practice didn't strike me as repulsive. No serving men circled the tables. If a fair one wanted something too far away to reach, he either stood up and got it himself, or had it passed to him, hand to hand, with the risk it might get eaten capriciously by someone else along the way. Wine bottles went around, and we all poured ourselves a glass. My tastes weren't refined, but I took one sip and knew the vintage was worth its weight in silver. Wine was one of the few things we didn't make in Whimsy. It was imported from the world beyond at great danger and expense. I selected pieces of fruit and pastry the same way as the fair folk, but when it came to eating the goose, which glistened with honey and spices, I took up my knife and fork. As I carved the meat, I felt I was being watched. By the time I looked up, several fair folk were wielding silverware, carefully watching my example, and a few others examining their utensils curiously. It was obvious most of them had never dined with silverware before. Why, then, did they arrange their place settings this way? "Because that's the way humans do it," I thought, with the smallest prickle of unease. The conversation went from my craft to other human works. The fair folk discussed clothing and swords. I fielded a number of baffling questions, and had to explain again that being a master at one craft doesn't automatically reward me with expertise in the others. As the feast wore on, my hope of overhearing even a scrap of useful information about the other courts, the summerlands, and corrupted fairy beasts crumbled beneath the barrage of small talk. As the sky darkened tonight, fireflies came out in such numbers they glittered in the trees like stars. A few fair folk summoned ethereal lights in different hues that hovered above the table. When I grew cold, Rook was quick to offer me his borrowed jacket, and seemed very glad to be rid of it. Whether the colors suited him or not, the cut of Gadfly's tight-fitting waistcoat certainly flattered his form, and it was an effort not to stare at him in shirt sleeves. The cravat was long gone, leaving his collar open at the throat. Over time, a strange pattern revealed itself. A smiling fair one passed a dessert or fancy up the table in my direction, only for Rook to intercept it before it reached me. The fifth or sixth time this happened, he even had to reach all the way across the table, stretching over a wheel-sized mound of grapes to snatch it out of Lark's hand. He sent me a troubled glance as he regained his seat, bracing his hand on the armrest. By this time he'd had quite a lot of wine, and I thought it was beginning to show, an observation which made me equally conscious of my own condition. The presence of so many fair folk was, admittedly, easier to endure after a few glasses. I leaned toward him, trying to ignore the way the lights swung when I moved, and murmured, "Are they enchanted? Poisonous?"
"Not as such," he replied in a tone of discomfort.
"Then why?" Our eyes met.
"It would be better if you did not know," he said,
with such a miserable look I didn't press further.
But Rook couldn't spot all of them, and eventually I discovered the reason for myself. Lark came hurrying back with a handful of tartlets, ate one herself, and handed me another. When I touched it, it changed. The pastry withered and fuzzed gray with mold. Whatever filling had been inside dribbled out as an unidentifiable black sludge, reeking of decay. Even worse, the deflated morsel squirmed in my hand. It was full of maggots. I threw the pastry shell to the table, missing my plate, and shot upright amid a noisy clatter of crystal and silverware, shoving my chair back with the backs of my legs. Just like that, the evening's magic shattered. All the fair folk stared at me from up and down the table, and though I knew it had to be my imagination, their eyes looked cat-like, glamourless in the shivering lights. Gadflies were so pale they glowed like a candle flame shining through quartz. My breath quickened. Then Lark, gazing up at me in stupefaction, gave a raucous laugh and snatched the spoiled pastry off the tablecloth. As soon as she took it, it wasn't spoiled anymore. It looked a bit squashed, but otherwise exactly the same as it had before. She stuffed it into her mouth. An amused titter went around the table, and the tense feeling in the air evaporated. Slowly, I sank back down. I looked at my plate to make sure I hadn't imagined the entire thing, that it wasn't some cruel trick they had played on me. I couldn't say whether I was more relieved or disgusted to see the maggots still writhing away on the china. A muscle moved in Rook's cheek. He exchanged my plate for his own, bending close enough that his hair brushed my still-raised arm. Afterward, he retrieved a handkerchief from the front pocket of the jacket he'd lent me and gave it to me in silence. I wiped off my fingers, but it wasn't the mold or maggots making my stomach revolt. I had touched mold many times before, and would many times again. I'd handled my fair share of spoiled food, and of course, I'd watched March eat all sorts of things. No, it was the knowledge that all around me sat empty people in rotting clothes, nibbling on fly-blown trifles while they spoke of nothing of consequence, with fixed smiles on their false faces. What would this feast look like with all the glamour gone? I imagined fresh grapes gleaming next to a dish of pudding turned brown as mud, swarming with larvae. Clotted fluid pouring from a bottle, imbibed without protest. The wine soured in my gut, as if it too had spoiled and festered. My simmering nausea threatened to boil over. I swallowed several times as saliva flooded my mouth. "I didn't realize fair folk could project their glamours," I said to Rook, desperate for an explanation, a distraction. "Lark couldn't change the dress until she held it."
"It is an uncommon ability. The illusion isn't as complete as a glamour. If a mortal touches it, it falls apart. Foxglove is the one doing it now, if I'm not mistaken."
Foxglove looked up the table at us, hearing her name spoken even in Rook's low voice. She smiled. "Does the illusion affect the..." I hesitated. "The taste at all, for you?"
"Ah," Rook said. "No. But generally, we care more about the way it appears."
At least he had the good sense to look embarrassed.
"This is the main point of contention between the Winter Court and the rest of fairy kind, if you had wondered,"
he went on impulsively.
"They believe that surrounding oneself with human things, all of this, even wearing a glamour, is a perversion of our true nature."
"And how dispiriting their lives must be,"
said Gadfly behind us.
"I do so enjoy being perverse. In fact, I rather think it is my true nature."
I would have jumped if not for the wine slowing my reflexes. I was certain that a split second ago, Gadfly had still been at the opposite end of the table. I looked over my shoulder, unease sloshing in my head as I turned. Rook and I hadn't been behaving too familiarly toward each other, had we?
"Thank you for your hospitality, Gadfly," I said, fumbling for the first polite remark that came to mind. "The feast is lovely."
His spidery fingers alit on the back of my chair.
"And yet it isn't quite, is it? Isabel, I'm sorry you encountered one of our less immaculate dishes. I thought Rook up to the task of watching over you."
Beside me, Rook frowned. An inexplicable urge to defend him seized me. "He has done as well as anyone possibly could," I replied. It came out more forcefully than I intended, and I added quickly, "Truly, I'm fortunate to have been waited on by a prince in the first place."
"Yes, of course,"
Gadfly said, glancing between the two of us. Shit. I plastered on my politest, most vacuous smile, refusing to give him anything else to go on. Let him think me charmed by the attention of a handsome fairy prince and nothing more. Not that there was anything more. Rook's feelings were the ones that needed hiding, not mine. "I do admit, sir," I continued, "that the incidents left me feeling unwell. If I'm to rise early and begin my craft at a reasonable hour tomorrow morning, I think I ought to retire before midnight."
"Very sensible."
Gadfly's fingers drummed out a thoughtful rhythm, too close to my cheek for comfort.
"Lark, would you please show Isabel to a room? Our best, of course."
Rook seemed about to protest, or perhaps offer to help me instead, so I bumped his knee under the table as a warning. I had no doubt he'd find his way up eventually, but it needed to be more discreet than escorting me upstairs in full view of the court. Lark wobbled upright and insinuated herself around my arm.
"I have so many nightgowns," she said, towing me toward the tree stairs. "I want to come," exclaimed one of her friends, who had been introduced to me as Nettle.
Lark whipped around and hissed at her. Nettle sat back down. Lark smiled prettily, tightening her grip on my arm. When we reached the tree's base and began our ascent, the feast's lights glittered like a whole city behind us. Weaving up the vines behind an equally unsteady Lark, I feared for my life nearly as much as I had during the Barrow Lord incident. Somehow, we reached the top unscathed. Enough starlight filtered through the labyrinth's leaves to see by, and the corridors sparkled like a diamond mine with fireflies. "Would you mind if I fetched my things from the bird hole?" I asked. The ring had lurked at the back of my thoughts all evening, and after the feast's strained conclusion, I couldn't bear going without it any longer.
"I don't know why you care about your boring dress, but that's where I keep all my nightgowns, so we have to go there anyway. You'd better not wear it to bed."
"I won't," I assured her, "but I'd certainly keep my iron close." By my estimation, I tried on nearly a dozen silk nightgowns, all of them flimsier than a slip and nearly see-through, though I found I didn't really mind, the final, conclusive sign that I'd had too much to drink. Lark settled on a green one, deciding this was to be my signature color. It gathered beneath the bosom and had a questionable number of ribbons for sleeping in, unless perhaps one used a hammock and needed to be tied down during high winds. But it was stunning. I wished I had a mirror to see myself in. No, I wished I could see what Rook's face would look like if he saw me wearing it, how different it would be from the way he'd gazed at me in the dragonfly dress. I stepped back from the thought immediately, my face burning, but no matter how hard I tried to ignore it, the fizzy glow of the idea wouldn't fade. Finally, Lark permitted me to gather up my things and led me through the twinkling labyrinth toward another room. I stopped dead in my tracks at the doorway. The room contained a four-poster bed, and dozens of gadflies stared at me from within. Some polished, some dusty, some hanging slightly askew, the portrait frames hung on almost every square inch of the room, depicting gadfly in different fashions across the centuries. They were secured in place by leafy vines so that they appeared partially grown into the walls. A few were my own work, perhaps 8 in all. I hadn't seen most of them in years and felt a shock when I spotted them, as if recognizing the faces of old friends in a crowd. In the blinking firefly light, their eyes seemed to move. "Surely I can't sleep in Gadfly's room," I said. There was no resisting. Lark tugged me inside.
"Of course you can. Gadfly only sleeps once a month, during the new moon. The only other reason he comes in is to look at his portraits. Since this is your craft, he'd be very pleased to have you stay here."
That made sense in the bizarre way of fair folk, and no doubt Gadfly thought it a great privilege to spend a restive night being stared at by all his faces. A flurry of laughter rose up from the feast below, and Lark gave a disconsolate pause.
"If you'd like to go back down, I won't blame you," I said. "I won't be good company once I've gone to bed."
She grasped my hand.
"Oh, are you certain? Absolutely certain. Oh, I just can't bear the thought of you being lonely up here all by yourself."
I smiled. "I won't be lonely. I can hear everyone down below, and I'm so tired I'll fall asleep instantly."
"You're wonderful."
Lark clasped my hand to her chest.
"I knew we'd be the best of friends. I'll see you tomorrow, Isabel."
And she released me and pelted from the room. I shivered, stuffing my hand into my armpit to warm it. Then I put my clothes down on the covers, sat, unlaced my boots, and slipped beneath the blankets, a fine, goose-down coverlet with soft sheets beneath. For some time, I watched the doorway. When Lark didn't reappear, I stole my hand out to feel around in my dress pocket. I held my breath as I blindly searched the folds, imagining what might have happened if a fair one had discovered the iron. But presently my fingertips bumped its reassuring shape, and I twisted beneath the sheets to slip it into one of my stockings in the dark. Conversation and laughter drifted up from below, almost comfortingly human. Yet I could not, would not fall asleep. Above and all around me, Gadfly's smile shifted subtly in the winking firefly glow. At the periphery of my vision, the changeable light made his eyes seem to move, and sometimes even blink. I had the feeling of being watched, without the luxury of knowing for certain that it was only a feeling. And it occurred to me I hadn't checked under the bed, a childish notion. But it wasn't difficult to imagine a fair one lying down there in the dark, spidery fingers folded over his chest like a corpse, smiling to himself as he prepared to leap out and surprise me. Wishing it were safe to wear my ring, I clenched my hand so tightly my nails dug dents in my palm. It felt like over an hour passed. It might have been less. Something clattered loudly in the hallway.
"Wretched teapot!"
Rook's voice exclaimed in vexation. Just like that, my fear melted away. My chest shook with laughter at the image of Rook staggering, drunk and affronted, through the labyrinth's crowded hallways, being assaulted by falling teapots.
"Rook," I whispered, trusting he would hear me. "Are you all right out there?"
A mortified silence. Then, coolly,
"I haven't the faintest idea why I wouldn't be all right."
"That's true," I said. "You slew a barrow lord. You shouldn't have any trouble with a kettle."
He came into the room, wrestling with Gadfly's green waistcoat. When he'd gotten it off, he cast it aside onto the floor like a piece of rubbish. Then he strode right over, and in one smooth motion, insinuated himself into the bed next to me, facing me, under the covers, with the bold and unself-conscious vanity of a cat sitting down on an open book. I lifted myself on an elbow. My skin prickled with the awareness that his bent leg was almost touching mine, that I could feel his body heat across the narrow space beneath the linens. Recalling the state of my dress and my dangerous thought from earlier, I drew the blankets close.
"What are you doing?" I asked. "You can't sleep here."
"Yes, I can. In fact, I must. I can't let any harm befall you, so it's best I stay close."
"You could offer to sleep on the floor like a gentleman."
He appeared horrified by the suggestion.
"And I'm not certain you're in any state to protect me," I went on, sensing a lost cause. "Just now you were almost assassinated by a teapot."
"Isabel."
Rook looked at me gravely.
"Isabel, listen. The teapot is of no consequence. I can defeat anyone at any time."
"Oh, is that so? That's the truth?"
"Yes,"
he replied. I grappled with exasperated fondness. Despite how annoying he was being, I found it shockingly difficult to resist smiling.
"Then you must be very drunk."
"I am not. There may have been a lot of wine, but I'm royalty, you know. I'm the Autumn Prince. Therefore, I'm only a little drunk."
With that, he closed his eyes.
"You can't sleep here. You really, really can't. It's too..." The room's leaves trembled as someone came racing up the hallway.
Oh, no,
I groaned. Quickly, get under the bed or transform. Wind lifted the covers, and a soft, slithery maelstrom of feathers caressed my arms. When it settled, Rook crouched indignantly in raven form among the tousled bedclothes, wings akimbo, as though his body had transformed automatically on my suggestion without his agreeing to it. Before he could change his mind, I snatched him beneath the covers and clasped him against my stomach. Right as I finished, Lark peered around the doorway. She stared at me for a moment while I pretended to sleep, then giggled and raced away again.
No, I said when Rook began struggling. If you're going to stay, you must be subtle about it.
He kicked his legs and nibbled my fingers, trying to free himself so he could transform again. I saw that more extreme tactics were necessary.
What a pretty bird you are, I crooned.
His struggling slowed, then stilled. I felt him cock his head.
What a lovely bird, I repeated in my syrupy voice. Yes, you're the loveliest bird.
I stroked his back. He made a pleased muttering sound in his breast. Soon, his smug silence indicated that he was quite content to remain as he was, so long as I continued my praise. I knew I wasn't truly safe now, but Rook's presence, such as it was, came as an undeniable comfort. The day's exertions drew over me like heavy wool. Rook's heart beat against my fingertips through his soft feathers, and my eyes sank closed as I murmured drowsy endearments to the spoiled prince nestled against my stomach, warm within a nest of blankets. Wink, 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 went Gadfly's eyes overhead. 100 of him watched us with unknowable smiles as we drifted off to sleep. The line of fair folk waiting for a portrait stretched so far down the tree-lined approach to the throne that I couldn't see the end of it. No evidence of last night's feast remained. Try as I might, I couldn't spy a single grape or crumb on the mossy lawn. The entire evening might as well have been an illusion. Presently, Foxglove sat across from me, wearing a smile that suggested her tight collar was slowly asphyxiating her. I wondered how she had achieved the coveted first place in line, and then decided not to think about it too closely. Queasiness curdled my stomach. Formulating my grand plan had been one thing, executing it was another. What if Foxglove saw the results and flew into a rage as Rook had? She had no reason to, I told myself. The context was completely different, but the fact remained that if they turned on me, I had only my wits and one iron ring for protection, now a hard lump inside my tightly laced boot. And, I thought, and Rook. I knew with the same unshakable certainty that sunrise came at dawn that Rook would defend me from the other fair folk, even at the cost of his own life. The thought was not romantic, rather it was grim. If this scenario ever came to pass, I couldn't think of any way it might end without both of us dead. I spared a glance toward where he sat near Gadfly's throne. He looked elegant but uncomfortable on the brocade chair that had been brought for him, bent over restlessly with his elbow resting on his thigh, half listening to whatever Lark was prattling into his ear. He caught me looking, and our eyes met. I noticed, for no particular reason, that a lock of dark hair had fallen over his cheek. Quickly, I returned my attention to my work. For Foxglove's portrait, I had chosen human joy. It seemed to me that what passed for joy among fair folk came in two varieties. The first was something akin to the self-righteous, frigid gladness a cheated-on wife might feel upon hearing that her husband's mistress had taken a fatal fall down a flight of stairs. The second was a vain, selfish, and indulgent pleasure, a rich nobleman calculating that his silver mine had earned so much money he could survive on caviar alone for the next 3 centuries, were he to live long enough to enjoy it. And so, as I inked Foxglove's features in blueberry pigment with the tip of Rook's quill, I gave her the swelling, radiant joy of being swept up in a lover's arms, of seeing a beloved figure coming down the road after months apart and recognizing his silhouette against the morning light. Without the crisp and glossy perfection of oil paint on canvas, there was something raw about my work, less beautiful, less realistic, but stronger. A stray line by Foxglove's mouth that I couldn't correct suggested she was holding in a smile. Laughter welled up behind her crinkled eyes. Working in this imperfect medium made it easier to transmute humanity, the court alchemist turning gold back into lead. When I was finished, I rose and curtsied. Foxglove approached to take the sheaf of bark from the stand. All around, the court held an indrawn breath. No one spoke, and I sensed an unusual stillness from Gadfly's direction. Though only a heartbeat passed, a lone heartbeat in which Foxglove expressionlessly scanned my work, the pressure built and built in my chest until I felt like screaming.
"Oh, how quaint!"
she exclaimed in a high, clear voice like the ringing of a fork against a crystal glass. She turned the portrait just long enough for the waiting fair folk to have an unsatisfying, half-second look, and then whipped it around again to resume her own perusal. The quality of her smile had changed. She had an empty look in her eyes. While the court whispered gaily behind her, the prior tension diffused. She stood there, frozen, staring at a version of herself that felt human joy. No one noticed the oddness of it but me. No one but me and Gadfly, I corrected myself, and Rook, glancing toward the throne again. They, too, watched Foxglove closely. Lark's words came back to me, just like how Gadfly knows things before they happen. Earlier that morning, he had declined the honor of sitting for my first demonstration. I hadn't made anything of it at the time, but now I wondered. Was he waiting for something? Something he had seen? Movement fluttered in the corner of my eye. I looked back in time to see Foxglove walking briskly out of sight, the portrait held in front of her as though she'd unwillingly been given an infant to hold for the first time in her life. Finally, almost imperceptibly, the feather shook between my fingers. I held my breath, seeking calm. Swallowtail approached next. His flaw was his hair, which was spider silk blonde and so impossibly fine it floated about his head like milkweed fluff. He looked to be between Lark and Rook in age, and his large eyes and youthful features lent themselves well to an expression of human wonder. He dashed away clutching his portrait when I was finished, and went down the line boastfully showing it to everyone, particularly those who had several hours left to wait. The day stretched on. Each portrait was a single stepping stone, the sum of which would form a path home. I lost count of how many portraits I did, marking them only by the emotions I used. Curiosity, surprise, amusement, bliss. The pigments dwindled in their teacups. Throughout it all, I felt Rook watching me, and firmly avoided sorrow. Every fair one reacted differently to seeing themselves transformed. Some laughed, as if at a delightful joke. Some flinched and giggled skittishly. Most of those, I observed, were younger-looking fair folk. Others, usually the older ones, stood and stared like Foxglove, and a few more went and sat down, gazing quietly into the distance, with such an inhuman expression I couldn't begin to guess at their thoughts. Though fair folk ceased aging once they looked about like Gadfly, it seemed to me these were the oldest ones of all. Painting straight through the day was as arduous as running a marathon. My right elbow ached from being held for hours in a bent position. My buttocks and knees became sore from sitting. My fingers, cramped around the quill, first grew stiff, and then painful, and then numb, joints spasming whenever I straightened them. Most of all, my face hurt from smiling. My frozen expression must have eventually become rather horrific, but none of the fair folk appeared to notice. After a time, many of those who had had their portraits done gathered for games on the lawn. I was relieved to find myself no longer the sole focus of attention as the courtiers played shuttlecocks and ninepins nearby. A spirited atmosphere overtook the gathering. Behind me, I heard, rather than saw, Rook shift in his chair. My smile grew genuine as I imagined how much it taxed him to stay put for so long. Finally, he exclaimed,
"I must say, I don't see the point of sitting here any longer,"
and trotted off to beat Swallowtail at lawn billiards. He then lost a game of blind man's bluff to Foxglove, but rallied and defeated everyone shamelessly at both ninepins and shuttlecocks. Lark fluttered behind him like an inquisitive butterfly as he proceeded to win every match in his path. The fair folk played at a human speed, I noted with interest. Perhaps this was the only rule that provided a challenge. On several occasions, I saw a feathered projectile fly past a player at a distance they surely could have reached with little effort. Rook had left his coat behind. Every time he twisted his body, an inch or two of his white shirt showed beneath his tightly fitted waistcoat, accentuating his slimness. His rolled-up sleeves put his muscular forearms on display, and the faintest sheen of sweat gleamed on his throat above his unbuttoned collar. Having seen him slay fairy beasts without perspiring, I recognized the exertion of holding himself back. With each swing, each strike, he struggled not to flaunt his power like a warhorse prancing stiffly in a flimsy parade harness. Without warning, heat rushed through me. The morning before last, had he broken a sweat then, too? I remembered the way his hands had felt, lifting me as though I weighed nothing, running down my sides, pressing me against the tree. With burning cheeks, I finished contouring the lines of my subject's hair, whipped it off the easel, and passed it on. He ran off laughing at the expression of befuddlement on his portrait's face and settled into a game of ninepins. My next subject sat down, smoothing her skirts over bare, bird-frail knees. The heat died like coals dashed across winter flagstones. It was Aster.
"Good afternoon, Aster."
I scraped up the last of my reserves, addressing her as though nothing was wrong, as though merely looking at her didn't make my skin crawl. "Do you have anything in mind, or would you like me to choose an emotion for you?"
"Oh, you choose, please. I'm certain you can choose better than I."
She gave me a wan smile, but her eyes were ravenous. Twisted in swathes of muslin, her hands trembled. I knew what she wanted, and I wasn't sure I could give it to her, or more importantly, whether I should. She wanted to see herself mortal again. I dipped Rook's quill. A bitter smell of crushed acorns rose from the bowl as I made my first line in dark ochre. I felt as though I were pouring a glass of water that I was about to show from the other side of prison bars to a person dying of thirst. In that moment, I hated the green well more than I ever had before. I hated that it existed and that people wanted it. I hated that I had sat on the edge of it and not felt the vileness radiating from its mossy stones. How dare it look the way it did, an evil thing, a hollow thing, surrounded by ferns and bluebells and singing birds? Had Aster had any way of knowing the eternal horror to which she was agreeing? The tip of the feather quivered with the force of my anger. I outlined her features in bold, violent strokes. The ink spattered as I worked, giving the sense that her portrait was coalescing onto the page from particles of darkness. Her sharp chin, hollow cheeks, and over-large eyes took shape beneath my hand, raw in form, but true. I changed the angle of her face so that it was slightly lifted. Her eyes gazed directly at the viewer. "How dare you," they blazed. Her mouth was shut, but her upper lip curled. "How dare you do this to me? Where are your consequences?" She looked as though she were about to spring forth from the page to enact vengeance, to wrap her fingers around someone's throat. "I shall deliver them to you." Thus I gave Aster my rage. Ugly rage, human rage, the rage she deserved to feel but could not, because it had been taken from her forever. When I finished, I was breathing heavily, and a strange energy buzzed through my veins as though my blood had been replaced with a howling wind. As I met the eyes of Aster's portrait, A thrill sparked through me. She was alive on the page in a way even my craft rarely achieved. She was real again. I needed to stand. The gale force within me demanded movement. I rose painfully from the chair, unable to feel my thighs or buttocks, my knees creaking. I brought the portrait to Aster, who watched me approach with polite confusion. The bark shook in my hand. At the last moment, I remembered to curtsy. Across the court, dozens of elegant forms bobbed obligingly back. I needed to get up, I explained in a harsh voice. I cleared my throat. Mortals' bodies aren't designed to sit in one place for long periods of time. Murmurs of understanding rippled through the line. Everyone had been observing me, trying to make sense of my actions. Yes, of course, mortals were so fragile. I handed Aster her portrait. She studied it. A curtain of long, dark hair fell over the side of her face, so I couldn't see her expression. Finally, she raised a finger and traced the still wet ink, smudging it. She dragged the smudge all the way across the bark, to the edge of the canvas, pressing hard enough that I thought she might crack my work in two. When she reached the edge and released it, the bark flipped up to its original position. She turned her stained fingertip over to look at it. "I remember," she whispered, and she angled her head just slightly toward me, enough for me to catch a glint of her eyes through her hair. A bell might as well have tolled through the clearing, a bell only I could hear. In Aster's eyes, rage, true human rage, struggled like a fire guttering wildly in the night. Goose flesh rose all over my body. So quietly I almost didn't hear her, she said, "Thank you." The spell broke. She stood up, her expression blank, so blank I almost wondered if I had imagined that angry spark, but I knew I couldn't have made it up or mistaken it. She wandered onto the lawn with her portrait dangling limply from her fingers, apparently without a care in the world. But when she sat, she kept the portrait angled downward against her lap, like a secret she was determined to keep. I steeled myself and turned around. "Sir," I said to Gadfly, "my craft has wearied me, and I'm running low on pigment. May I take a break?" He clapped his hands together.
"Of course, Isabel. You needn't even ask, you know. You're the guest in our court and deserve every courtesy I can offer."
The fair folk waiting in line sighed as one, whispering their disappointment.
"Now, now,"
Gadfly chastised them before his attention sprang back to me.
"Would you like someone to escort you through the forest? Rook, perhaps?"
He suggested this without a hint of guile. I glanced toward the game of shuttlecocks and found Rook standing there watching me, chest heaving with exertion, his game forgotten. A birdie whizzed past his head, ruffling his hair. "No, I'll do quite well on my own." I spoke evenly, hearing my own voice as though it came from someone else speaking around a corner. "I plan to remain close by, and I wouldn't wish to trouble the prince over something so small." I had no way of knowing whether Gadfly's question truly was innocent. If he were to suggest anyone to accompany me, Rook was the natural choice. But I couldn't shake the scrambling paranoia that he knew. Perhaps that he had even seen something, something in the future. I smiled at Gadfly and curtsied my leave. Then slowly, deliberately, I gathered up the teacups and walked away toward the glen, where the top of Rook's autumn tree spread its scarlet leaves in the distance. I felt Rook's gaze searching me, but I didn't once turn to look. I had to accustom myself, after all, to leaving him behind. As I slogged through the undergrowth, I assured myself Rook would be all right. He was probably already languishing insufferably after having beaten everyone at shuttlecocks for the dozenth time over. But why did he have to be so utterly, stupidly transparent? He might as well have "I'm in love with Isabel" written across his face for everyone to see. With a frustrated shout, I yanked my boot free from a vine's ensnaring tendrils. Even the delicate spring foliage had started to feel less friendly. Fleeced with clouds, the blue sky beamed as harmlessly as gadflies' smile, and squirrels bounded along the branches above me, shaking loose showers of white petals. But if I had learned anything from fair folk, it was not to trust the way things appeared. I cleared the thicket and sat down on the same stump as the afternoon before. A breeze rattled the leaves of Rook's tree, and a few twirled downward, scattering across my lap. I picked one up and traced its edges. Its colors stuck out like a sore thumb, much like Rook himself. Things weren't going entirely as I'd expected. I shouldn't have let myself get so carried away with Aster. There was no mistaking that she had felt real anger, human anger, as impossible as it seemed. Not only that, my portraits had affected some of the others, too. I'd been painting fair folk for years, and never once had I seen such reactions to my craft. Foxglove had felt something, I was sure of it. Perhaps she had experienced emotion, or perhaps she had caught a glimpse of what it meant not to, and found herself confronted by the emptiness of her existence, the hollowness of never having once known joy. I wasn't certain which possibility was more alarming, or more dangerous. All I knew for certain was that I couldn't fail. My life wasn't the only one at stake. I realized I had torn the leaf apart, stripping it down to its fibrous veins. I flung away the pieces and put my face in my hands. My eyes prickled. My heart ached. Even if everything went perfectly according to plan, and I was working myself up over nothing, I faced a future I was no longer certain I could bear. "I wish you were here, Emma," I mumbled, wanting nothing more in that moment than my aunt's embrace. She would know what to say. She would reassure me that I wasn't a terrible person because there was a part of me that didn't want to go home. Perhaps she could even convince me that I could live with myself after I buried my heart in the autumn lands and left it behind forever.
"Who's Emma?"
a cheerful voice asked, right next to my ear. I nearly jumped out of my skin.
"Lark, I didn't know you were there."
She sat perched on the edge of my stump like her namesake, smiling at me with her hands cupped around a pile of freshly picked blueberries. When she saw my face, her smile vanished.
"You're dripping."
"Yes, I've been crying." Seeing her raised eyebrows, I added, "It's what mortals do when we're sad. I miss my Aunt Emma."
"Well, stop now, please. I've brought you some blueberries. Gadfly told me you were out of things for your craft. Here."
She poured the blueberries onto my lap, in the basket my skirts created between my legs. At the last moment, she snatched a few back and stuffed them into her mouth. I felt strangely touched. "Thank you, Lark. That was very thoughtful."
"Yes, I know. I'm simply full of thoughts, but no one cares to realize it, and everyone treats me as though I'm the silliest creature in the spring court."
"I don't, do I?" I asked, concerned.
"No, and that's why I like you so much."
She sprang to her feet.
"Come along now. Let's find more berries."
With a wet laugh, I plucked one of the blueberries from my lap and popped it into my mouth. Its ripe, tart flavor burst sweetly on my tongue. A black-eyed raven alit on the uppermost branch of Rook's tree. Lark grinned, showing each and every one of her sharp, purple-stained teeth. I knew I shouldn't have eaten that berry, shouldn't have considered eating that berry, even before the world spun in a kaleidoscopic wash of color. I plummeted downward as though a hole had opened up in the earth beneath me. The sky receded, growing smaller and smaller, surrounded by a warm, soft, rumpled darkness that I first grasped at frantically as I fell, then recognized with senseless horror as my own clothes. I thrashed, smothered by fabric on all sides. My body wasn't working the way it should. My face, my limbs, my very bones had taken on an alien assemblage that sent terror jittering up and down my spine. As I strained for any sense of what was going on, two long appendages swiveled on the back of my head. For some reason, I sniffed, and my flexible nose twitched in response. My heart beat so rapidly I couldn't identify the feeling at first. It was like a trapped wasp buzzing madly in my chest. I kicked free of my clothes and hopped through the shoulder-high grass, half-blinded by the sun, finally grasping the nature of my transformation. Lark's enchanted berry had turned me into a rabbit. Her shriek rang out behind me, stabbing my tender ears. Impossibly, my heartbeat kicked up another notch. I thought my heart might burst as I raced toward a hawthorn bush that loomed above me higher than the tallest bell tower in Whimsy and broader than a house. The forest had grown so dauntingly large, it hardly bore looking at. I needed to get somewhere dark, safe, and enclosed, right now.
"Run, run, run!" Lark laughed. "I'm going to catch you, Isabel!"
With a dreadful unspooling of my memories, I recalled what she had said to Rook the day before. "Can you turn into a hare for me again and let me chase you about?" I thought of the way Rook had been ignoring her in favor of paying attention to me instead. I skidded under the bush, sending dirt and platter-sized leaves flying. My fur slid sleekly beneath branches that hung mere inches above the ground. I zipped forward, aware Lark must have seen me disappear under this bush, and judging by the sound of her laughter, she was already following. There, a hole. But as I approached the burrow dug into the hawthorn's roots, I shrank from the rank odor emanating from its depths. My instincts screamed danger. Somehow, I knew the thing that lived in this hole would eat me if it got half a chance.
"Oh, you're a quick one. I think I've lost you."
Through a space between the leaves, I watched Lark's gigantic feet stomp over to the bush across from mine. She bent and looked under it, her golden hair cascading down in a shimmering wave as huge as royal tapestry. It was obviously a game to her. Surely she didn't mean me any harm. By the sound of it, she used to play this game with Rook often. Yet if she caught me, would she understand I was a mortal rabbit, not a fair one in rabbit form? Might her fingers go around my little ribs and squeeze them just a bit too hard? I shuddered, recalling that if fair folk caught rabbits, they ate them raw. And what if she was truly upset with me for stealing Rook's attention from her? Before I had a chance to think about it too hard, she whipped around to stare directly at me.
"There you are!"
She bared her stained teeth again and scuttled forward, bent at the waist, her arms extended, fingers curled into greedy claws. I spun and zoomed off, targeting a stand of honeysuckles. They weren't as dense as I'd have liked, but I lost her by leaping behind a log coated in a thick growth of spiraling ferns. I couldn't help but eye them as I passed. Perhaps, if I escaped, I could double around and try nibbling on some later.
"Isabel! Isabel!"
Lark sang out sweetly.
"Where have you gone, Isabel? You know I'm going to find you. I can hear you. I can smell you."
The ground shook, and great crashing sounds came from behind me as she thundered into the honeysuckles.
"You're just a silly hare."
A silly hare, a silly hare. The words ricocheted between my ears, losing their meaning as my whole being narrowed down to a single primal urge. Survival. I lived to run. Emerald light and leafy shadows whipped past, my body bunching and stretching straight as an arrow with every stride. I dodged to avoid stones and roots in my path. If I zigged one way, then zagged another, the beast lumbering behind me would get confused and fall behind. I froze on top of a boulder to look back. My nose spasmed with the effort of getting enough air, flaring red. Heat evaporated from my ears. The pursuer had stopped to look under a log. Mightily, it flipped the log with its upper appendages. Even from a distance, I heard soft bark crumbling, tender ferns uprooting and tearing. One of my ears rotated of its own accord to better take in the sounds. Then the pursuer straightened. Danger! I dove from the boulder and streaked across the clearing. One of the stumps in the clearing seemed familiar to me. It had fabric draped over it and teacups beside it. I was unsettled by the sight, as I might be by seeing a hawk's shadow pass over the ground. And then, from an angle I did not expect, a predator descended. No, no, no! I was caught. I kicked my feet and twisted, screaming, showing my teeth. Giant hands had seized me and now lifted me. The sun flashed in my eyes, the world soared dizzyingly, and the grip that held me was too firm for escape. I drummed my feet against the creature's chest, but he cradled me so close I couldn't move my legs, and lifted some of his clothes to press my face inside. Enclosed darkness, muffled sounds. I stopped struggling, thinking that perhaps the peril had ended. In the sudden quiet, only my heart galloped on. The sound of it filled my ears and shook my body in swift, rhythmic pulses.
"Lork,"
the creature said. He didn't shout. I sensed he didn't have to. His voice was like a cruel wind, stripping everything in its path to the marrow.
"What have you done?"
A petulant voice answered.
"You don't play with me anymore, Rook. No one pays attention to me except for her, and you're trying to keep her all to yourself. It isn't fair."
Nose twitching anxiously, I burrowed farther into my captive's garments. That voice was danger. But the smell of the creature that held me, a crisp leaf smell, a night air smell, was safe.
"You little fool. Did you ever pause to consider what would happen if she escaped from you? Look."
One of the warm hands left my back. I trembled.
"She's already forgotten what she is. She would have lived out the rest of her short years as a common hare."
A foot stomped.
"I wouldn't have lost her. I take care of my things. Rook, why are you being like this? You're being awful, just awful. I'm going to tell Gadfly how awful you are."
"Tell Gadfly if you like," my captor said. "But I don't think he'll be pleased to discover how impolitely you've treated his guest."
"Fine."
But the voice sounded uncertain.
"I'm going right now."
"See that you do,"
my captor said coldly. Footsteps charged away across the grass. With my ears flattened against my back, I couldn't hear well enough to determine whether the predator had left for certain. Even so, I wasn't afraid. I trusted my captor wouldn't expose me until the harm had passed. He lifted me from the darkness and held me up at face level. I regarded him calmly, with my hind feet dangling. I detected no one else in the clearing, no hawk shadows, no fox smell.
"Isabel, do you recognize me?"
he demanded. A shadow had fallen over his face, and his smell acquired a bitter edge. He was angry. Even then, I still thought to myself, safe. I wiggled my nose. He sighed and cradled me against his chest again.
"I'm going to turn you back. Try not to struggle, as I haven't had a great deal of practice with this sort of magic. That is to say," he added quickly, "I'm perfectly capable of doing it. I am sure you've noticed I excel at all enchantments, but it would be best if you remained still. So, please try."
I sat obligingly in his arms, wiggling my nose. At first, nothing happened. Then, just as I thought it might be a good idea to settle down for a nap, the world turned inside out, flipped over, and threw me down again as though I'd just spent a few seconds as a toddler's spinning top. Everything shrank. My body became heavy and fleshy and slow. I blinked in a daze, orienting myself. Red leaves whirled across the clearing, and the trees swayed in a subsiding wind. When the wind gusted its last breath, the autumn trees stood naked, bare-branched, without a single leaf left. I wasn't touching the ground. My feet hung in the air, and warm arms supported my shoulders and the insides of my knees. Rook. That was Rook holding me. I wasn't wearing any clothes. Before I could find my voice and ask him to set me down, he dropped me like a hot coal. I landed in the wildflowers with an undignified whoomp. Horrified, I squashed my legs together, hunched inward with my arms clamped over my chest, and stared up at him. He looked as aghast as I did.
"Why did you just..."
I began, at the same moment he blurted out,
"You stopped being in peril and I couldn't touch you any longer. Are you all right?"
"No!"
I'd just been turned into a rabbit.
"But I will be. Thank you for coming to my rescue. Couldn't you have set me down a bit sooner?"
He averted his eyes.
"I was distracted,"
he replied with dignity. "Oh, right." When he started shrugging off his coat, I forestalled him by speaking.
"I'm going to put my dress back on. Just don't look."
I stood and skulked over to the stump, conscious that lately I was doing an awful lot of sneaking about in the forest nude. Sporting a blush that spread all the way down my neck, I slipped back into my underthings, today's Firth and Maesters, and finally my stockings and boots and hidden ring, while Rook waited for me, gazing determinedly at a fixed spot away to the side. "Are they going to miss you back at the court?" I asked, hoping to dispel the tension, or at least refocus it to a more pressing topic.
"Undoubtedly."
He paused.
"Isabel."
I smoothed my skirts. The ground suddenly became very interesting to look at. "Yes, it was supremely idiotic of me to eat something Lark gave me. I shouldn't have gone off on my own either, but I'm worried the court, Gadfly especially, will grow suspicious if we spend more time together." The leaf I'd torn up had blown into one of the teacups. "And I needed to get away. You noticed it too, didn't you? What was happening back there?" When I glanced up, Rook's expression told me he would have brought it up himself if I hadn't first.
"Yes. Your craft is affecting us somehow. Isabel, I've never seen anything like this before."
"If I keep demonstrating, do you think it will put us in danger?"
"As I said, this is new. My kind hungers for your work, all the more for its difference. I cannot honestly say that I believe there to be no risk, but I do think it would make the court suspicious if you stopped now, with everyone expecting you to continue. If perhaps we stay for just one more day and leave after the masquerade ball tomorrow night."
A long pause elapsed, neither of us looking at the other. Our alliance had progressed far past the point of mutual survival. We both wanted to buy ourselves more time together, for decidedly unpractical reasons. It was no use pretending otherwise, and yet we left those words unsaid.
"But I'm almost healed,"
he went on decisively, forcing himself to finish.
"If you would like to leave today, even right now, we can."
I squeezed my eyes shut, cursing my foolishness. "After tomorrow night, then." His gusty sigh of relief wasn't subtle. I aimed a wry smile at him, but something else drew my attention. "Your pin's gone. It isn't in your pocket, is it? It must have been torn off when you dropped me." He patted at his chest in alarm and then ducked to hunt through the wildflowers. This wasn't the leisurely search of someone who'd lost a pocket watch or a handkerchief. Rather, he clawed at the ground with a wide-eyed desperation that could be inspired only by the loss of a priceless and irreplaceable treasure. When he found it, he gripped it tightly in his hand. He moved his thumb to the hidden clasp, but then he stopped himself, remembering I was there, and started to put it in his pocket instead. My heart hurt for him. It was painful to watch Rook reduced to this over something so small. He cared more about that pin than most people cared about everything they owned in the world. "Who was she?" I asked. On his knees, he stilled. I'm sorry, you don't have to answer that. I suppose I only wondered how the two of you escaped the good law." I thought he might be angry with me. Instead, he looked at me as though I'd torn his heart from his chest. His eyes dulled with shame and despair. He put the pin in his pocket.
"I was in love with her, but we never broke the good law," he said.
"How is that possible?" I wished I hadn't asked. His misery was terrible to see.
"She didn't love me back."
Silence reigned in the meadow. After a time, a squirrel started gnawing on an acorn overhead. He resumed haltingly.
"She was fond of me, but she knew she could not be anything more. We decided it would be best if we never saw each other again. She gave me the pin as a goodbye present. I stopped visiting Whimsy, and more time passed than I realized."
He looked at the ground.
"When I returned, I found that her great-grandchildren now lived in the village, and she had died long ago, of old age. Until your portrait, I never came back."
He drew in a breath.
"I know it's wrong that I care so much about the pin. I can't explain it.
It isn't wrong." My voice was so soft I barely heard myself speak.
Brooke, it isn't. It's just human.
He hung his head.
What has happened to me?
I couldn't stand it any longer. I went to him and pulled him into an embrace. He was so tall, I felt I barely accomplished anything. I had my arms wrapped around his middle like a child. But after a tense moment, he stumbled into my touch, as though he were too crushed by despair to stand.